great Newtown Square Township, Pennsylvania. We're really Newtown Township and Newtown Square, but hey, that's for a different conversation. Gentlemen, Kendall and Fitzy, how are we doing? What do you
this
got?
This was kind of a rough start to this pod.
That was a rough start.
I feel like you were sharp. I feel like I think we should roll through it. And I think people deserve to hear that you aren't always perfect on the openings. And I think that it's a life lesson here. Nobody's on all the time. Even the great Michael Patrick Rooney can have his false starts.
I feel like I just had a check swing punch out right there. Like it was just, I wasn't convicted. I wasn't committed to my swing.
You got to bring your hardest swing every time, even with two strikes, even if you're shortening up runes, you got to swing with intent every time. That's a good Monty Lee thing right there.
You know, my strategy with two strikes was actually to climb on the plate and get hit by a pitch. And so it was like that pitch that was away and I couldn't get hit with it. So yeah, it was problematic. So there we go. Gosh, dang, we're down early, boys, down early.
How are you guys? We're going to power through. I'm
good,
doing all right.
Man.
Kendall, you, how many pounds of, we were talking about your dogs, how many pounds of dog in the Rogers family right now?
Probably 145, 150.
Fitzy, can you rival that?
Hell no. I think we got two kind of, I guess they would call them, would you call them pocket pits? We got little pit mixes. I think we're probably about a total of, I don't know, let's call it 90 pounds total max.
What about you, Runes?
20 pounds of dog. Yep, great. The great Louis Armstrong Rooney. He's who we got.
Louis Armstrong Rooney.
Yeah, we're a small dog clan, and but now this is when we purchased Louis 17 years ago. We were not living in the mountains like we are now. The mountains are not good for small dogs. We have mountain lions and coyotes and javelina. So I'm knocking on wood right now, but so that may change. We'll see. Stay tuned.
Will the javelinas eat dogs? Are they predators?
They're just stupid animals, and they're clueless, and they get up on humans even because they just have terrible senses. And so I think they are very aggressive animals, just accidentally aggressive because they've got no clue. So
they're just your version of a hog, right?
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Yeah. Spanish hog. Yeah, whatever. So gentlemen, this Animal Kingdom podcast / Delaware County podcast is brought to us by our friends at Driveline. So let's talk about Driveline and thank them. And then I promise we will actually get into college baseball talk. I may even have a rant in me. So as we know, Driveline offers a variety of training, education, software, and hardware solutions for both players and coaches. Anyone in the coaching community, if you're overwhelmed by collecting different data sources, mass athlete programming, third-party analytic insights, here's what you do. You call Driveline, you email into support@drivelinebaseball.com, get yourself set up with your own custom player development bundle on the track platform. You could look into Driveline certification that will empower you to run Driveline type training, pitch design, and or biomechanical data collection with products like the Pulse Workload Monitor. There we have it. Thank you to the folks at Driveline. They are awesome. Boys, here's what I thought we would start with. I had a revelation, you know, so when the one-time transfer rule got passed, you know, the expression you heard is, hey, we're going back to the wild, wild west. And, you know, as you guys know, that's kind of when I was having my foray into college coaching. And I don't know, I always thought it was a little, no, of course, I was at an Arizona State where, you know, you are the poacher, not the poachee. But I always thought it was a little overblown. And I'll just tell you that, and maybe this is confirmation bias, as I'm reading the fall reports and listening to what you guys are observing when you're out on the road and I'm talking to coaches getting ready for my fall reports, I actually feel like the mid-majors have done way better in the transfer market than the Power Five. The Power Five programs have gotten some players, but they feel like fill-in players or role players. I feel like some of the mid-majors are getting some impact dudes. Now, again, it's relative, right? But I don't know. I just want to throw that out there. Kendall, why don't I start with you? What's your take on that? And maybe you're allowed to say, hey, I'm not ready to declare a winner. But what's your general feel for that so far?
Yeah, I don't think I'm ready to declare a winner, but I totally agree with you in the sense that I think mid-majors are coming out of this pretty well. This is my argument the whole time whenever they came back with the one-time transfer rule is that, you know, college baseball as a whole, I just felt like was in a much different place than it was 15 years ago. You know, you didn't have these mid-major programs building Taj Mahals like the Coastal Carolinas and programs like that. This day and age, I mean, I'm not going to say that Springbrooks Park is the standard like everywhere, But like, I mean, there are a lot of mid-major places or mid-major programs that are building ballparks, you know, almost as good as that. And so I just think when you have, you know, programs making a strong commitment, I think your chances of having players go, you know what, I've been at Mercer for 1 year. I'm going to go to, you know, LSU next year just because I want to be in a bigger program. I think that want to leave diminishes if your program is making a very strong commitment to baseball. So I actually felt they did it at a pretty good time. I think the numbers would show you, and the number of high impact transfers transferring out to bigger schools would tell you, at least in year one, that it wasn't a situation where these big schools were just going into the mid majors and just taking all their good players. That didn't happen at all. I mean, at least it didn't happen in mass quantity. So I think it worked out pretty well in year one. We'll see if it continues. Year one looked pretty good though.
What do you think, Fitzy?
Yeah. You know, I feel like I'm going to push back on you a little bit here, because I do think there are some, well, I'm picking push back on Runes mostly, I guess. I think there are some Power Five teams that really, really made out well. You know, I mean, you certainly a couple that stuck out in my travels were Oklahoma State and Arkansas. And, but, you know, one thing to note there is it's not like they're just picking off mid-major guys. I mean, you know, Oklahoma State, you're getting, Victor Medeiros from Miami. Arkansas is getting a Jace Borifin from Oklahoma. I mean, so they're doing well, but also part of that is you're getting other Power Five players. But, you know, then you get like a Michael Turner from Kent State. I mean, there are players like that who go to Arkansas because they've been passed over in the draft and they think this is their opportunity. You know, Griffin Dorsching at Oklahoma State from Northern Kentucky. These guys have put up numbers in their careers and they haven't gotten a chance in pro ball. And I think, you know, they believe they just, in order to have any kind of a chance to play pro ball, a lot of these players think they need to go to the next, you know, the next thing. And I think about Samford now. This is a program that, you know, they lost kind of their two big name guys, Brooks Carlson and Sonny DeShera, both to Auburn, right? And you think, oh man, they just got hammered. But, you know, they did a really good job reloading then in the transfer market. Mm-hmm. You get the bounce backs from the Power Fives. You get the, you know, maybe the guys that they have names, they have talent, they have pedigree, but they just haven't had opportunity or just hasn't worked out where they were. Obviously you're not going to get a star player to leave LSU for Samford, but you can get a Maurice Hampton who was a star recruit, a big time recruit, football guy. Also, I mean, that's a guy who could make a big difference at Samford. You know, Case Garner from Mississippi State, Brody Westbrook from Georgia Tech. They got Colin Ahern from Tennessee, Drew Byers from Notre Dame. They got five bounce backs from the Power Five ranks. And so, sure, they lost a couple of their biggest name players, but maybe they filled it in well with, you know, kind of that the next cut of guys from the Power Fives. And so maybe some of those guys will blossom, some of them won't. But all in all, I think it balances out pretty well. So I guess that's where I come down. I don't think that the mid-majors did necessarily better than the Power Fives, but I think that they did enough on the back end to make up for their losses in many cases.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah, I think, and you know, it's certainly too early to declare a winner. And I guess the part that I was most concerned about is, hey, kid goes to a mid-major and kills it. And then after his freshman year, you know, the school has invested scholarship in him and the coaches have coached him up and then he's gone. I feel like the guys that have left for the Power Five, you bring up an interesting point, Fitzy, the guys that are going Power Five to Power Five. I think the pilfering of the mid-majors has been more like their older players. And you know, like, I don't think Jeff Duncan at Kent State would look at the Turner kid and say, hey, like, we got screwed there. Like, that kid was a great player for you for several years. And it's almost, he really is just a grad transfer. I talked to Reggie Christensen at Sac State for my fall report, and man, they did really well. They got a kid, Josh Rowling, who's a middle of the field player who couldn't get on the field at Cal. Cause Cal does have kind of a really nice position player group right now. They got the Cesar Valero kid who was a big recruit to Oregon State, who same thing, just couldn't get on the field. They think he could be a more middle of the order of the bat. I think I look at UNLV, who, you know, the Mountain West just produces good position players, but pitching's trickier. And I think Stan Stolte and his staff at UNLV did a great job. They got a Peyton Fuller coming back from Oregon. They got a Josh Ibarra who wants to be a starter, but really wasn't able to get that role at UC Irvine. You know, they got the Rupp kid from Houston. They just, you know, I like the way UNLV, they got their hands on some pitchers that they probably can't get in normal recruiting, but through the transfer process, they were able to get. And remember, guys, in the olden days, you know, 5 years ago, 2 years ago, those kids would have had to go to junior college first and then recycle themselves. Now they're going right through. And I don't know, it's really fascinating. But I think so far, I wouldn't say that it's been a bad thing.
Yeah.
No, well, and I think, guys, I think as we'll talk about here in a little bit legislative-wise, I think there's an opportunity here for mid-majors to even come out even bigger on this issue. I mean, I think when you look at, you know, the legislative cycle and then some of the things the ABCA is, you know, proposing, like larger rosters, eliminating the top 20 or eliminating the 25% minimum, you're in a situation to where, you know, you're already giving the Michael Turners of the world a pretty big scholarship at a place like Kent State. So as you get, you know, bigger rosters, you're spreading out the scholarship dollars to more guys at the bigger programs. Like, they're not going to have the money anymore to go get, you know, Michael Turner away from Kent State if he's getting 60 or 70% there. And so I actually think that what will happen here is those star players will end up staying in majors, and these kids, you know, at the Mississippi States of the world, if they're not starting, like, okay, they'll just go to Samford for 60% the next year. You know, they'll just leave. They're not going to stay there and ride the bench at a place at Mississippi State or LSU. They'll end up going to those mid-majors, especially if the rosters are bigger and you can spread those dollars out even more.
It's funny, Fitzy, you mentioned the draft, and I think the draft's a big part of that, right? That's just dawning on me now, but it's like, hey, the kid at the mid-major that's played really well doesn't get drafted, but it also works the other way, where the kid who's buried at Mississippi State and really wants to play pro ball, but he's not going to get drafted keeping a chart, you know, at a big-time program. You got to get on the field if you want to get drafted. So, yeah, very interesting.
That's exactly right. I just think that as much as I was kind of skeptical of bringing back the, you know, Wild Wild West days. I mean, you heard all the horror stories 15 years ago about, you know, coaches going to the Cape and just basically recruiting other players. I mean, I didn't want that, right? But the fact of the matter is, you know, I think it's working out okay, because there are kids that just plain need a change of scenery, you know, in both directions, as we've talked about here. And I was just reading the St. John's Fall report that our guy Vitale posted up in the Northeast. And, you know, he mentioned Tate Ballestero from Virginia, a guy that I always liked. You know, I'd see him in the fall and be like, this guy looks the part. You know, he could be an impact guy. And they just didn't have a spot for him to play there. He never really got on the field much. And I bet he goes to St. John's and has a good year, and he can get himself drafted because he's got tools. So, yeah, there are opportunities for a lot of these players that, you know, I think it's good that you don't necessarily have to go to JUCO for a year and then bounce back, especially if you're maybe a third-year player. You don't have that option. This is just, I think, not a bad solution. You know, we'll see. I'm kind of back on board with this free market situation now. We'll see how.
How about this free market fit over here? How about that?
Well, you know,
I love it. Mean,
I'm not saying we need no regulation, but I am saying that right now I'm open to this kind of new world that we're living in, because it's only right for the players. You know, I think clearly the way that college sports are going, it's all about trying to make things, you know, better for the student athletes, because I think we can all agree that the student athletes have kind of gotten a raw deal for a long time with some of the legislative stuff across all sports. But, you know, I think now the players have a lot more power, and I think that, you know, the administrators realize that if they want to preserve the entire edifice of amateur athletics, if you will, then they need to make some big changes. And that means you allow players to transfer without sitting out again. Yeah. That's part of it.
Well, and that's going to be something interesting, guys, to talk about, talk to Chris Lemonis about next week, is like, you know, in this landscape of college athletics, like, how in the world as a national championship coach do you try to keep all of your players happy? Because, you know, as we've talked about the last couple of weeks, Mississippi State, like Arkansas, like some of these other SEC programs, you know, they're reloading with elite recruiting classes every year. So, like, as a coach, like, how in the world do you keep all these kids happy? I mean, obviously, they didn't keep everybody happy because they had some kids leave last year in the middle of the season. But, like, just that job, I mean, it's got to be difficult.
I think the answer is you can't. You know, I think we're – and that it's – this is a perfect segue. We got a couple segues coming here. But, you know, it's like – these fall rosters, and, you know, I think a lot of coaches, when they start recruiting at a high level like Arkansas is, you start to think about, hey, like, a big roster lends itself to problems. These kids are elite players. Think about this. You go from the best player on any team you've ever played on to second or third string. That's a really, really tough adjustment. Your dream is to be a Major League Baseball player, mm-hmm. but you're not even a starter on your college team. And so it's really hard to do that. And the best way to keep players happy is have a smaller roster. And so, oh man, it's a great point, Kara. Hey, let's do this, boys. So the ABCA did their survey on roster mm-hmm. management. And I loved what we did on Twitter is we kind of turned into a Twitter poll. So let's take our own Twitter poll. Okay. So Kara, I'm going to start with you, and Fitzy, we're all going to answer each question. First question. Mm-hmm. What would you do with the 25% scholarship minimum? Keep it, eliminate it. KR?
Eliminate it. I'll keep it extremely brief here. You guys know my opinion on this. Everybody does at this point. I just feel like in a partial scholarship sport, if you can get a kid to go to the University of Texas or the University of North Carolina for 4%, you should be able to do it. There's a lot of kids out there, as we all know from the showcase industry, there's a lot of kids out there who don't necessarily need 25%. And if North Carolina can get those kids to go to school there for 5% or 4%, let them. That allows more money to go to a kid that may not have as much money as those guys.
Yeah. Fitzy?
You know, I'm going to go back to the whole reason that the 25% rule exists in the first place. Now, remember, this all started because of baseball's APR. Remember the APR? That was a big mm-hmm. hot topic yeah. 15 years ago, whatever. Baseball had a bad APR because players were transferring so much and it just messed with the formulas. And so they wanted to restrict the transfer flow. And so that's why they eliminated that one-time transfer exemption. And in exchange for that, they thought they needed to make schools make a bigger commitment to the players on their roster. That's why they put in this 25% minimum. They didn't want a kid on book scholarship being told, hey, you got to sit out a year if you transfer. Now we've got the transfer market back open again. The 25% rule is totally unnecessary. I mean, you know, I already yeah, thought that it was kind of stupid, but now it's like, just why even have this? It's old news. Get rid of it.
Yep. With you, eliminate it for all the points you guys just
made. Can I bring one more thing up real quick?
Go.
Yeah. I was talking to Dan Heefner at Dallas Baptist the other day, and I asked him, I said, like, what is your take on, you know, eliminating the 25% and things like that? Like, you know, you're at a program that is considered kind of a upper mid-major. I mean, they've also had a ton of success, but I mean, they're in a mid-major league, let's face it. And like, he loves the idea. Like, he's like, hey, you know, people say, well, they're, you know, teams can come into our program and get players, but he's like, we can also, you know, reap the benefits from getting, you know, players for a higher scholarship from other programs. So he's like, he thinks that he was very much in favor of eliminating the 25%. And he also liked the idea of expanding rosters. He doesn't like the stigma of the walk-on in college baseball, which I think is a topic for another interesting discussion down the road.
Yeah, let's come. Let me do the easier vote, and then we'll come back to the roster size. So one of the other three questions we put on the Twitter poll was, should college baseball establish a football style redshirt rule? And if I were to paraphrase that, basically what it means is in football, a kid can play in four games and still be redshirted. It doesn't matter if it's the first four games or the last four games. The theory being it's still a very incomplete year of competition and they're finite, right? You only get four of them. So I love that. I would be in favor of that. Like whatever percentage we pick, let's say it's 25%. It's about, I don't know, whatever that is, 15 games.
14 games.
Yeah, 14 games. I would be cool with that. It's a great way to get somebody some action in certain spots who's probably, you know, it's in the kid's best interest to redshirt. I think that's in the spirit of the rule. I'd be in favor of that. What do you, Fitzy, you go. What do you think?
No brainer. I mean, yep. What's the downside? I don't see any downside.
Yeah, I don't see any downside either. KR?
I'm for it. I do prefer the first half of the season. Because one of the questions of the ABC survey was, you know, allowing at any time. I do think there's an element there to, you know, if the other team doesn't have a freshman that they've been.
And they just show up at, you know, in regional time and throw some guy who hasn't thrown all year. I feel like that's kind of an advantage.
Yeah, the only thing I'd think is like you can't predict when a kid's going to have an injury. That's the hard part. You know, yeah. Especially on pitchers, like when does a guy get ready? Or, you know, when does – what you know, when – I don't know that the pitching thing is so unique in that regard. So that's why I kind of prefer that any four games, but I think here in application, it's probably fairly unlikely that a kid who you're going to redshirt gets active at the end. And then, yeah, if you're moving into the postseason, then those postseason games would count against that participation percentage, I would think. So Yeah, I think that one's a fairly easy one too. What do you guys? The final question was on roster size, and okay, what would you do with the 35-man roster limit in the future? Keep it, eliminate it, raise it. Fitzy, what are you thinking?
I think I'm in favor of a little raise. I mean, I think 40 is a decent number, but I mean, you know, I don't really have that strong an opinion on this. I don't think 35 is tragic. You know, I think that there are cases where, you know, the Mike Fox example we always talk about. Mike Fox was a walk-on. He was not one of the top 35 players on his roster back in the 70s when he was at North Carolina as a player. And he turned himself into something. And he had a whole, you know, life and career because he was able to walk on and have that come. And he talked about just the value of the camaraderie for these kids that even if you're not a relevant player, and if you are, you know, one of the last five guys on the roster, you know, if you never really get into games, you know, maybe you're giving these kids kind of a sense of belonging on campus that, you know, that is valuable. And I think that's fair. So yeah, I think I'm okay with like 40. I don't think we need to go bigger than that. I just think that's excessive, but I'd be okay with 38 or 40.
KR, you got a thought on this?
Yeah. The more the merrier to an extent. I'm good with 40. And I think as long as we're getting rid of the 25% and, you know, we're allowing kids to be on 5%, there's no reason not to go to 40. So I like it. You know, it like he just mentioned, it gives the ability to the of the walk-on to at least get something financial aid-wise.
Yeah, I go all over the place. Where I struggle with this is we do have to give coaches leeway because the draft's so unpredictable. So they have to be given some space for that. Where I struggle is with the bloated fall rosters. What I don't like about that is that then the kid gets cut because there are going to be a lot of players cut at the end of this, like any moment. And then they have no choice but to go to junior college this spring. And not that junior college is some banishment. I mean, it's a great baseball opportunity in a lot of ways, but it's kind of a contradiction, right? Like, hey, the kid knowingly chose to be one of 50 guys at blah, blah, blah university. So I get it. Like there's free choice there, but then at the same time, the system doesn't allow that kid, the kid, if he wants to go to somewhere Division I, he will not be eligible in the spring. So that part I struggle with. It's almost like, when do you, cause here's the thing, guys, if we say 40, you know, if you're player 38, let's be honest, you're a long way from the field. I mean, only 27 guys are even on the travel roster, and 27 guys aren't playing every weekend. And that's not the case. It's more like 17 or 18. So maybe 20 if there's some blowout games. So that's where I struggle is, when do we make coaches make the decision? Is it before, you know, what's more traumatic, getting cut in August from a program you thought you were going to, or getting cut in December from a program that you're already at? I don't have fully baked out thoughts on that. It's tricky either way. I don't think there's a great answer there, but I'm with you, Fitzy. Like, I don't have a super strong opinion here, but 40 feels reasonable to me.
Runes, I'm going to fire you up here, but what would be your number for a maximum fall roster? Because I know you're pretty passionate about the fall rosters being a little crazy.
I think if I was going to do that, I would go 45 is a number that's top of mind. I mean, it's still a massive number. It gives you plenty of personnel to inter-squad scrimmage a ton in the fall. Hey, if you have a Division I school that feels like, hey, having a higher baseball enrollment helps the school, the health of the school, I think it allows for that. Now, you know, that's not very typical of a Division I program. That's more stuff you hear at Division II and Division III, where they're using sports to create enrollment. But I think 45 is a pretty dang big roster. And, you know, like players 46 through 50, I mean, man, I don't know. Like, are you really making that team? Because to me, making the team means you got to number 27. Otherwise, you're working out on your own. I mean, that you're not on the team if you're not in the first 27. So I don't know. 45 is a number that's top of mind for me.
So what's the answer as far as players that, you know, we'll use the word get run off at the end of the fall? I mean, is there, should we open it back up so that you can transfer freely at the winter break, do you think, like it used to be, or do you think that the way it is now with going to the JUCO ranks is sufficient?
Oh boy. You know, here's the one thing that the January thing, I think you're doing coaches a favor not letting the kids transfer in, because even for the junior colleges, I'll just never forget. We brought in 2001. We brought in Andy Torres. He won 13 games, by the way. He came in. He had to come in late because of academics from East Los Angeles College, JUCO. And he just never gelled with our team. Ian Kinsler came in January and never felt comfortable with the team. Like, because think about it, guys. Like, the team's working out all fall. Guys are winning jobs. Oh, and then, oh, by the way, Ian's going to be our shortstop. And it's just like, it's not fair to the kid. And so I'm really hesitant on that. But by the way, we're doing exactly that to junior colleges. I think that's one of the reasons why I like the, you know, a fall roster limit, is you're asking the coaches to make these decisions quicker, and it's still hard on the kids, but you're giving them more time to recover.
Yeah. I mean, if you give a guy a chance in August to find another D1 school that wants them, I mean, I know it's a quick turnaround, but, I don't know. I'm with you that this part of it seems like kind of the seedy underbelly of college baseball, really, because, like, you know, you have to over recruit and you don't always know how many people are going to come back, especially in this era with this reduced draft and all the various things we've had to deal with the last 2 years with COVID. It's not easy, but, you know, I don't think these giant bloated fall rosters are necessarily a good thing. Now, I don't know they're certainly, I think, not a good thing. The question is what do we need to do something about it or not? Or is it just something that we're stuck with?
Yeah. Here's the thing, guys, it's competitive, right? So it's just like business is competitive. Life is competitive. So coaches have to cut players. The question is, when do we ask them to cut the players?
Yeah.
And, you know, there's cutting players is no fun. It's hard. It's hard on the players. It's hard on coaches. It's tricky. So, yeah.
Answer the question, Runes. What do we do?
I would go, if I was the czar of college baseball, I would go 45 for the fall. That would be, you know, I think that's anything greater than that is just kind of, you know, I don't see the benefit of it, honestly. You know, even Mike Fox, I think, is probably going to be in the 45, to be honest. I mean, it's a huge number, right? Like,
that's pretty big. Yep.
Yeah. It's almost double the travel roster in the spring.
I like that. I like that, Mr. Czar. I think that's a satisfactory.
Make it so, as you would say.
Put that on your platform.
That's right.
Do you guys know, like, I'm actually not going to go on my rant, but you know, you guys know, I get really frustrated with the bureaucracy of the NCAA, and I'm doing research on a possible pitch clock article, podcast conversation, and I've had really fun conversations with pitching coaches, and it just gets me fired up and frustrated about how we do things in NCAA baseball. But I got to the point last night where I Googled who is in charge of NCAA Division I baseball. I Googled that. Who runs NCAA Division I baseball? Like, that makes me so mad, so frustrated that and no offense to Anthony Holman, who seems like a brilliant dude, but he played college basketball. And I don't think he's ever been to a college baseball game. I feel like I'm attacking Anthony Holman. I don't mean this. Like, I don't think the guy is a college baseball fan. He's just a really talented, smart executive at the NCAA who got put in charge of college baseball. And so that just kind of, and I don't even know if he's still in charge of college baseball, which is probably ridiculous that I wouldn't know that. But so that part frustrates me, is like, we're considered a revenue generating sport, and we've got some, you know, like this roster limit, like this is a really difficult issue. Some of these issues do not have easy answers, but yet, I don't know, is Anthony in charge of college baseball, or is it like these 12 subcommittees underneath him? Or I don't know. The NCAA almost makes the federal government look efficient at times. And it's, you know, the federal government's 1,000 times the size, you know, 1,000,000,000,000 times the size, whatever it is.
I'll definitely say this, like the last mover and shaker I felt like we've had at the highest level NCAA wise is Denny Pope.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, know, like, I felt like he was like, a little bit of a
he was a fan. Like, I could say I could disagree with Denny Pope, but I felt like, hey, I feel like this guy really cares about our sport. And this
I think Damani fits in that. Damani Leach probably fits into that category too. I thought he was, you know, someone who was really comfortable with the sport and knew it inside and out. And but you know, we've just had a lot of turnover at that position since Denny left, since Denny retired. And I'm with you, Ruse. What we need is Mr. Czar Rooney or a Czar Peterson to be the guy that comes in here and just calls the shots. Let's go, Runes.
Yeah, just like I shouldn't have to read like the fifth paragraph into Anthony Holman's bio at the NCAA.org to realize that, oh, by the way, he's in charge of this sport that is our national pastime and generates whatever 8 figures of revenue for the NCAA a year. I mean, that's just gosh, it just feels epically stupid from a business perspective that that's how you would, hey, what's that little business over there make, like $20 million a year? Somebody else throw that on their plate, you know, just for extras. I mean, what is that?
Let's go to the new guy.
Yeah, that's right. Oh gosh. Give it, let the X-ray technician handle it. They'll figure it out. Oh my gosh. Oh, lovely. All right, boys. Let's get on to a positive topic. So the D1, I might mess up the lingo because this is new for me. The Player Society, D1 Baseball Player Society, is kind of our foray into NIL. Obviously, we've got three players that are going to be part of it so far. Bob Moore of Arkansas, the most famous Bob Moore. Curtis Washington Jr., who's now at Purdue, and Garrett Ostrander, who's at Cal Baptist. So I think you guys are too. I'm getting a lot of questions on, hey, what's this about? I think the description online is pretty dang good, but you know, some people aren't pouring through every word. Kendall, why don't I start with you? Give me your take on this and where, you know, what you're excited about for the Player Society.
I think the biggest thing from my perspective is like just seeing things from the lens of the player. You know, people's, you know, read what we have to say. They read what coaches have to say. But like, what does the player think about the everyday grind of college baseball? And I kind of said this on an interview a while back, but like, it's not just, you know, the Bob Moores at Arkansas. As much as I love Bob, and I probably would have just canceled the Player Society had Bob Moore said no. But as much as I want to see what Bob Moore thinks, like, I'm actually really intrigued to see what a guy like Cal Baptist thinks. What is their like everyday life like as a student athlete and baseball player at Cal Baptist? I want to know what it's like at Northwestern or what it's like at Harvard, especially after they didn't play college baseball last year. Like, to me, that's really intriguing. So I'm just looking forward to seeing everything from the perspective of the college kid, especially in this day and age where they are doing some writing. They are all on social media. It's a totally different environment from even, you know, when KP and you were playing college baseball. It's like a total 180.
Yeah, fair. Fitzy, what's your take?
Yeah, and I think it's also a great chance for us to kind of showcase some really dynamic personalities and guys that have built a following on social media. You know, I understand, you know, Mr. Ostrander has a great TikTok game. You know, Curtis Washington, from what I hear, has just got all kinds of followers on, you know, Instagram and whatever other platforms. But it's just, there's the personality shines through. You know, these are guys that really get it. And there's more on the way. But yeah, I mean, Kendall, certainly to his point, part of it is kind of just the student athlete experience, but it doesn't all have to be. You know, some of it can just be kind of goofy stuff, top of mind, you know, just let these personalities shine. And it just kind of, I think, brings more life to our coverage here at D1 Baseball. We're still going to have the same old stuff that we've always done, but the Player Society will just kind of give you kind of a glimpse into, you know, the life and minds of some of these players. And there's been a lot of interest, guys.
Sure.
And I, you know, I hate that we're gonna have to turn a lot of people down because we only have so many spots, but boy, oh boy, people are excited about this, that the kids are into it. So, you know, we're going to have a nice group.
I would say it this way too, guys. Like, you know, I get asked the question fairly often, hey, you know, do you miss coaching or what do you miss about coaching? And even though it has been quite a while for me, but you know, what you miss is the players, right? There's nothing like coaching these kids who are 18 to 22 years old, which is such a great age group. It's like there's maturity, but still tremendous optimism. They're so good. They're so skilled, right? Like they're just really good players. And so, yeah, like this is a chance to kind of reconnect with that part of the community besides just like doing one interview with them once a year, right? And, you know, and just looking at the mix of these three guys, I mean, Bob Moore was the guy, high profile, dad's a GM of a big league club, went to college early, right? I'd love to hear more about Bob Moore's decision to take himself out of the draft and go to Arkansas as a true freshman, skip his senior year of high school. Curtis Washington, we had this transfer conversation a little bit ago. Curtis Washington was at Arkansas, right? If I'm not mistaken. And then to get more playing time goes to Purdue. And then Garrett Ostrander, you nailed it, Fitzy, or Kendall, you said it, like, hey, like, you know, Cal Baptist, a really good college baseball program who's a little bit off the radar. So let's hear what their experience is like. And so, I think this is really cool. I think we're really on to something here, and it's going to be fun to see what these guys have to say. Go ahead, Fitzy.
And there's going to be, you know, different platforms too. I mean, there's, we talked about the social media stuff. Obviously that's a big element, but you know, if some of these guys want to do a podcast, I think there'll be some podcasts in the works. There could be some, you know, some writing. There could be some post game video kind of stuff. I mean, there's you know, all kinds of possibilities. So I'm excited to see where it goes. It's brand new for us. You know, we're going to learn as we go. The players are going to learn as they go, but it's an exciting possibility.
Yeah. We could have a pretty good podcast idea on the way as well.
Yes. Yes.
I love that. Yes. Good tease right there, Kara. Yeah. Hey, boys, let's finish with this. So this is one of my favorite times of the year on the website. Fall reports are just awesome. They're such an in-depth look. I know I've mentioned to you guys, I even catch myself during the season going back to fall reports, because it is like some guys were kind of under the radar in the fall and they bloom in the spring. Other guys, the opposite occurs. I love going back and referencing fall reports. I'm doing it this fall. Like, I'm going back and looking at my fall reports from the year before, which is so fun. And there's a bunch that are on there. You know, the ones that are top of mind for me is we had Rebel Monday, the Helium guys. So it was well played. We had Ole Miss and UNLV on the same day. Illinois is up there. Minnesota's up there. South Carolina is a really interesting one for me. St. John's, you mentioned already, Fitzy. So Fitzy, let me start with you. Pick one of those and something that struck you from reading that fall report.
Let's see.
Could be one that you wrote too, if you,
you know, yeah. I mean, you know, I feel like we've talked more about the ones that I've written. A lot of them have been SEC type programs, but you know, Ole Miss is going to be awesome. We don't even need to talk that much about them. I mean, they're going to hit a ton. And, as I wrote in the report, I thought the six arms that they threw, probably their six best arms, were all really impressive. So, the Minnesota report, that Patrick wrote was interesting to me, because this is a program that was 6-31 last year. You know, frankly, like, wouldn't normally have a report on a 6-31 team. But you know, those guys are getting after it up in the Midwest and the Big Ten, are trying to get all those teams done. And this is a really good program. It's hard to, you know, remember sometimes, but like, they were hosting a regional just, what, 2017 was it? It's not that long ago. So, you know, I think they're going to bounce back pretty good. I mean, there's some of the talent in this report sounded very exciting. Obviously, Sam Ireland is the guy that I know Patrick's very high on, but there's a bunch of them, you know, and if some of these younger guys develop, and this is a development program, you know, they've always been like that at Minnesota. They typically have a lot of players redshirt because they get these kind of raw, you know, cold weather kids that, They're not usually going to get necessarily like the top recruits even in those cold weather places. They're going to get guys that are toolsy but raw, and they're going to, you know, develop them over time. And so I think them having the COVID thing really interrupt their development, you probably hurt a program like Minnesota more than most, because boy, they just count on that development time. So it sets you back for more than just the 1 year that you lose when you lose that development time.
I would tell you guys on Minnesota, I'm all over the, first of all, Patrick does such a good job on these fall reports, guys. Like, I get, when I see it on the website and I see that Patrick's the author, I read them all and I love them all, but Patrick really pours himself into these things. I'm all over the place, because one thing you just mentioned, Fitzy, I actually had that super regional in 2018, and I would tell you that Minnesota team was really, really stinking good. Like, if they don't get sent to Corvallis, I think they could have got to Omaha. Like, no one was beating Oregon State in that super regional. Yeah, I mean, that Oregon State team, we come to find out later, there was four first-round picks in their lineup. Hello. Yeah. So, like, that's a problem, right?
And who's that really exciting shortstop they had? The name escapes me. What was his
Grenier?
Name?
Minnesota.
Grenier?
Yeah, from Minnesota.
Minnesota. Zach Vavra, right? Vavra.
Taron Vavra.
Yeah.
Taron Vavra.
Yeah, Taron. He was great. Yeah, really good player. So anyway, but honestly, I had Minnesota last year, and it was, you know, let's just call a spade a spade. It was the worst team of John Anderson's 40 years in Minnesota. I mean, by far. Yeah. And I'm like all over the place. Are they going to bounce back? You're right, Fitzy. Everything you said about the core of that program is development. They take Minnesota kids almost exclusively. Man, I don't know. I just don't know. I feel like it's a coin flip. I don't know what to think, because it was really real. I mean, I'll tell you this, guys, on the mound last year, it was just flat terrible. I mean, it was terrible in every way. The strike throwing was abysmal. And so that they're going to have to make huge strides in that area, but the program track record probably tells you that they will. I don't know. Crazy. KR, pick one.
Yeah, I'm going to go with South Carolina. I kind of find those guys as one of the more interesting teams in the SEC. I mean, I think this is a big year for that coaching staff. This is a big year for that program. And, you know, I kind of come away with two thoughts on South Carolina, and, you know, Aaron can kind of probably either echo or respond to this. But, you know, I think when you look at those guys offensively, obviously getting, you know, Andrew Eichter and Braylon Wimmer back's big. But, you know, I think those three transfers for them could weigh pretty heavily, you know, on what the results are at the end of the year. I mean, obviously Matt Hogan's really talented out of Vandy. Talent certainly was not the issue with him last year. You know, Kevin Madden put up really good numbers at Virginia Tech. And then Brant Belk, I mean, his numbers weren't crazy, but I mean, he was a very, I thought, steady player in the Southeastern Conference for Missouri. But what kind of concerns me a little bit is when I look at their pitching staff, you know, I saw Julian Bosnick and I saw Will Sanders several times last year. I think I saw Sanders up to 95. I saw Bosnick really nasty. I really like both those guys, but I kind of felt like from reading Aaron's report a couple of weeks ago that, like, once you get past Bosnick and Sanders, especially with Mahoney and guys like that out, you're kind of like, okay, I have some question marks about this pitching staff. And so I guess for me with South Carolina is the final word is I'm not real sure what to expect from them. I mean, like, I could see them being solid, but I could also see them finishing from, you know, based on what he saw from Georgia, finishing behind Georgia, behind Tennessee, behind Kentucky. I mean, Kentucky looks like a team roster-wise that should be much improved this year. And of course, behind Florida and Vanderbilt. So, I mean, they could be, I mean, near the bottom of that, right ahead of Missouri.
Yeah, I do think I would have them behind Georgia. I'm actually very high on Georgia. Yeah. That fall report is not out yet, but I saw them this past weekend, and I liked what I saw. And talking to people who saw scouts that saw them repeatedly, I think they're going to have a good year. I don't think people are really talking a whole lot about Georgia, but watch out for them. I share your concern with South Carolina. For me, it just comes down to how good is the pitching beyond that 1-2 punch. And I think that's going to be a good 1-2 punch, as you talked about. Those guys have real stuff. But then I just think there's a lot of question marks on the mound. You know, I feel a lot better about it if they had Phipps and Jackson Phipps and Jack Mahoney, both of whom had Tommy John. Without those guys, you know, maybe Kate Austin can step up in his second year. You know, maybe a transfer like a James Hicks or Noah Hall. I did like what I saw from Hicks, 91-93 power arm guy with some field of pitch and the three pitch arsenal. I mean, there's stuff to like there, but, you know, it's just, it feels like they had a bunch of guys that have some velocity, but they've got a lot of guys that have kind of been kicking around for several years and always had some stuff, but never, you know, like the Parker Coins and the Gil Reiths and the, you know, the Wesley Sweats and the CJ Wines. I mean, there's all these guys you've seen flashes from them, but we haven't seen the kind of consistency. So I like the fact that they have some arm strength and some depth of arm strength, but they got a lot of prove it guys to me.
Gosh, it's there. And here's the thing, Mark Kingston came to that program and first year goes to a super regional. And I, you know, there's this story out there that Ray Tanner told Mark, hey, like that was actually a bad move, right? Like that's when you're rebuilding a program, you know, our fan base, the expectations are fairly aggressive and you actually just
fairly aggressive.
Yeah, that's right.
And so, well, and the sad thing about that is now, you know, a lot of, you know, how fan bases can turn on you. And it feels like after a couple of years now, it's like their expectations are, I just want us to suck and move on. And it's just like, come on, man, like enough of that, enough of that. Support your players, support your coaches in your program. You know, this is that stuff is obnoxious. Yeah. And it's gotten to a point where anytime you tweet anything about South Carolina or some of these other programs in the SEC that I could name, it's just like the fans instantly are just like, you know, they're just totally over it. And it's like, man, give me a break. Like South Carolina hosted a regional last year. I know they lost that regional and they were a 2-seed. They didn't have like an awesome year, but like anytime you host a regional in college baseball, you're doing all right. The program is doing just fine. Like chill out.
Yeah. And negativity does not help the cause, right? Like you want to really get your program in a downward spiral, you know, just bad scene is just keep making changes, you know, it's to your point, this is, I don't want to sound overly critical, but where a fan base like South Carolina, which I think is a real strength of the program in the best of times, it can become an actual, you know, a non-asset in difficult times. And that's a problem. Like that's not good.
they're harder on their players than just about anyone else out there. I mean, in my experience, it makes it, you know, the players hear that stuff. They're not deaf. You know, they can hear when the fans are ripping them, or the fans are, you know, making it so that the coach's family doesn't even want to come to the game anymore, as has been the case at times there. I mean, that's not constructive, and it definitely makes it harder for the kids on the field to actually do their jobs.
Well, and the one thing I think fans, I mean, frankly, I think fans at every SEC school should realize is, like, this conference has gotten better over the last 5 or 6 years. Like, Alabama is getting better under Brad Bohan, and Auburn had a tough year last year, but Auburn's gotten better. Tennessee's a heck of a lot better than they were 6 or 7 years ago. So, you know, to expect what they had under Tanner, it's just, I mean, it's unrealistic.
Yeah. So tricky. Hey, boys, let me give you a couple summary thoughts from these fall reports. So first of all, Illinois, Justin Janis, their first baseman, one of my favorite players in college baseball, 6'3", 200-pound left-handed hitter who's just kind of like a Dave Maggett and just sprays the ball around, won the batting title in the Big Ten last year, and then did the same thing in the Northwoods League. So just kind of like this pure, pure hitter guy. Justin Janis of Illinois, I'm all in. Ole Miss, Fitzy. I read your report and I'm thinking, dang, I think they might actually be better on the mound this year than last year. It's the dumbest thing I could ever think, because they lost Nikhazy and Hoagland, but they kind of lost Hoagland anyway, right? Like, right. I'm kind of, when I think about Ole Miss last year, I'm thinking without Hoagland, and they were so thin on the mound last year at the end. They feel way deeper on the mound to me. They don't have a Nikhazy that we know about, right? Like that's, you know, that kid's a unicorn. But I was really intrigued with their pitching when I left there. You know, you guys talked about South Carolina. I'll tell you, I'll end it with this on UNLV, guys. I had so much fun writing that report. And one of the things I really get a thrill out of is a program that just feels like they found their groove, like their identity is really, there's clarity there. And Stan Stolte is a big time college baseball veteran. Hey, we have to remember that in 2014, when UNLV, you know, had made the regionals, and then Tim Chambers, who's the late Tim Chambers, is, you know, that there's a lot of turmoil around his health, and it just feels like the program has incrementally got themselves back on good footing. And hey, they've got a good recruiting base. Nevada's got good players. Arizona's got good players. Southern California, they don't get the pick of the litter, and they've done this really good job, like I mentioned earlier, getting transfer pitchers to provide some depth. They're not going to be one of the best pitching staffs in the country, but they don't have to be. They got, you know, they were top five in the country last year in batting average and slugging percentage. So, the environment lends itself to that. But anyway, I get a kick out of programs that just find this groove and they just kind of stick in it. They really know who they're trying to be. So, and that's probably my favorite part of the fall reports is you just get this flavor for these teams, because you're not just looking at the headlines. Like these fall reports really get you deep in there. And so that part has been really fun for me.
I think these are the best season previews, you know, materials out there. And we're going to do our whole season preview again, you know, once we get to January and February. But a lot of times it's just like, you're kind of taking information from the fall reports and scaling it back, because you can't write, you know, 2,000 words on every team in a conference preview, but a lot of times we're writing 2,000 words or more in these fall reports, and you're getting, you know, 30 guys into the roster, sometimes more than that. You know, there's some of these reports you're mentioning 35 guys. I feel like we're really drilling deep into these things. So to your point earlier, Runes, at some point in the next year or two, you can be like, oh yeah, why do I know that name? And then you're going to look back at a fall report and be like, oh yeah, because, you know, Runes saw him at this scrimmage in Tempe and wrote about him. And it's like, it just took him a while to get there, but maybe in May, this guy pops up and it's like, oh yeah, he's on the radar because we saw him in the fall. And so I just think those looks really matter.
Love it. Gentlemen, well done. So if I was going to grade myself in this podcast, I'm going to go C-. But I thought you guys were both A's, and that's the way it should be. Even when the point guard's having a bad game, the shooters are getting shots up. I still think we won this podcast, but I will say, gentlemen, that I'm going to have to go watch the tape and be pretty hard on myself. Not.
I actually thought, other than the intro, you were really good.
Yeah, you recovered well.
But like your worst intro is like our best intro, and we did it just the two of us. So,
well, I appreciate you saying that.
I mean, I think you're selling me a little short. I was a serviceable intro, man. Serviceable.
Oh, that reminds, that's still my favorite expression from any of our podcasts this year. David Esker talking about his freshman suit, you know, now sophomore pitchers, they need to be unrecognizably improved. So right. That is my goal for the next podcast, boys. My study intro will be unrecognizably improved. So that I pledge to you. Well done, boys. Special thanks to our folks at Driveline that sponsor this. This is fun, guys. This is one of my favorite times of year, the fall. We will have tons more fall reports coming out, and we will get back at you on the airwaves next week. So everyone have a good one, and we will talk to you soon.